Doc Leipzig, the oldest festival for animation and documentary in the world, is happening in a hybrid format in 2020. We're embracing the opportunities that come along with it. Welcome to the new Doc Industry Program podcast, realized in collaboration with What's Up with Docs, the Programmers of Color Collective, and independent film industry curator Temba Bebe. Welcome to a series of discussions on subjects such as story sovereignty, diversity and inclusion in the documentary industry, and decolonizing our industry in general. These podcasts are funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM, and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Enjoy.
Hi, my name is Martine Joelle, and I'm a curator and narrative artist, and I believe the practice of wonder through storytelling is an act of equity. This podcast is commissioned and hosted by Doc Leipzig, the oldest festival for documentary and animated film, with a rich and storied history and an incredible team. As a part of this program, we're honored that this series is commissioned and curated by POC2, the Programmers of Color Collective, with the amazing support and vision of Lucy Mukherjee. POC2 facilitates connection, conversation, and opportunities for a network of people of color, inclusive of Two-Spirit and LGBTQ programmers through international film festivals to serve as a catalyst for inclusive programming, festival staff, and senior leadership to support diverse talent. We especially want to thank Bridget O'Shea, the head of industry at Doc Leipzig, and we are just so happy to be here. So one of the things that I love about film is this entry point of entering other lives through a lyrical or poetic sensibility. And there's an amazing poet, Robley Wilson, who has a poem, In the City of Your Heart. And it gives this idea that the observer is invited to walk the street when you're most yourself. So the intimacy and invitation of that got me thinking about what is joy and energy and resilience through storytelling and through documentary film. And in order to have that conversation, I wanted to bring together a group of amazing curators who are in that space. And I'm really honored and grateful to have Janelle Brown, who's a curator, educator, and amazing voice in cinema, and Maria Cristina Villasenor, who's a programmer, writer, and curator. And I'd love for them to introduce themselves and share a little bit about what your interests are and how joy and resilience relate to your roles and in the world.
I'm really happy to be here. This is really exciting. Thank you, Martine, for inviting me. And I'm, happy to be in conversation with Maria Cristina as well. As Martine mentioned, I'm a curator, programmer, educator, and just a general arts worker. And for me, I think that there, and I think, I guess we'll get into it in our conversation later, but I think there are myriad ways to map joy, and sometimes that can include contending with trauma and contending with violence, but really, really finding the pockets of life in which, the modality is not just the survival, but the modality is transcending that. So for me, that's what I'm interested in, and I guess we'll unpack later. But so, I think that there are complex ways to manifest joy, and then also there's myriad ways that that is then also represented in documentary, nonfiction, and other kind of adjacent cinematic forms.
Yeah, that's so well put. That's a challenge following up, but exactly what Janelle noted is what I've been feeling as well. I am a curator and writer and programmer of films that I hope really hew to the framework that you're putting around them, Martine, and which I really appreciate, that notion of wonder and also practicing wonder. I love that it both captures this ethos and this this experience, but also that it's practice, right? And I think that it's really important for us all to be sharing a space in the BIPOC community where we're sort of reminding ourselves that that practice is okay, that we're that we're defining it, that we're sharing it across different experiences and frameworks, and how each of us define it slightly differently. But I think sort of giving ourselves a space to do the work as we define it, and to say that that is honest and that is generating wonder and awe, and that is kind of just making more space, right, for more voices. In my own curatorial practice, I try to do that really across audiences. I am a programmer at the New York International Children's Film Festival, where I really take the mandate seriously of expanding conversation and sort of expanding, certainly joy, but also more complex experiences as you can navigate them through film for young audiences, and really see that as starting from the various, the very youngest viewers to the next generation of filmmakers and so on and so forth, and expanding inclusion and diversity in that. But also getting back to what Janelle said, I do also feel like that experience of joy is very often something that, has a root in that idea of allowing ourselves to experience pain and trauma at times and loss. But I think for me, what is really inspiring right now is that that is very much and articulated through an artist's own voice. And so it's really about voice and that sort of navigation of someone's experience through their own voice that's kind of inspiring me in film right now.
Thank you both so much. I have so many thoughts already. what I'm also hearing, there's this sense of whether it's an artist's voice or the intention that you bring to your curatorial practice, this sense of beginner's mind, whether it's audience facing, if it's young people. One of the films that I kept coming back to is a documentary film student right now that was released, and thinking about how when you don't necessarily have the entire framework of what the traditions have been, that there's a bit more freedom to map your own way, to make the road by walking. And I'm curious if that's something you're also thinking about in terms of where a filmmaker might be in their process, whether they're sort of working through trauma as a way of bringing joy, or whether it's, this is a consistent thematic that's gone through multiple films. When we look at kind of mapping in the sense of cartography, the people that hold privilege and power tend to map our borders in our world, and kind of decolonizing the ways that those borders are made, the ways that we talk about that. And I was sort of just mapping that over to when we think about whose stories are centered now, and if it's a young filmmaker who is sort of using experimental forms or doing things where they aren't particularly going towards a certain tradition. It's just, this is what I want to explore. This is a sensation of joy or resilience that I need to figure out for myself, for my own process. But also I find when people talk about young people's cinema, there tends to sometimes be a dismissal of the privilege that there is to make films for young people, because you're forming the next generation filmmakers, of lovers of storytelling. And also there's an inherent question about power in young people's stories, and also how we view young people in society. So however that is inspiring you, I'd just love to know, like, what is that beginner's mind or way of looking feel like for you?
Following the path of emerging filmmakers and seeing how they are very open to divagations, I guess, if you want to take that mapping analogy further, you might see this very fixed route that's offered to you, in this age of Google Maps or whatever, where it's, what's the most expeditious route? And usually the most expeditious route to a career, right, is following genres and things that are predefined, and this exact idea of, how you're supposed to craft a career in film. And I think what's interesting and the youth space is looking at those emerging makers who are kind of wresting that genre back from those expectations. So I'm thinking of a filmmaker in particular who we featured in our last festival, a wonderful young artist, Cameras Johnson. And he made a film with Pedro Piccini, and it's called Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad. And it's very much this lyrical first person account of loss. It's about his father and his dear friend who Cameras grew up with sort of as a kind of de facto uncle, a good friend of his father's that was embraced as a family member all along. And Cameras recounts his dad's losing his friend to an untimely death, a natural death, but an untimely death. And it's really his own navigation through that space through animation. And the animation is wonderfully vivid. It does call upon some kind of more traditional tropes, you might call them, in terms of looking at things like how do you talk about male relationships and emotions and loss and sort of vulnerability and recapture that and sort of cast that in a superhero's kind of light. So you have, you know, that kind of imagery, but you also have like, I think there's this great full frame shot in the film. It's, the film is called again, Grab My Hand, of just two hands, two black male hands grasping each other and just that kind of forefronting of that. And so to me, what's interesting is Cameras and Pedro taking on this like very established style, really, because there's also the question of whether like animation is a genre or a style or medium. And I think all of that play, right, of really bringing in this emotional valence of, you know, taking kind of these like pop cultural tropes of taking a format and saying, I'm going to own this. I'm going to map it the way that I want. I'm going to dip in and out of these things and, you know, not presuming what is in Cameras's mind as his end goal. He's got a rich career and all kinds of possibilities and projects that are on his plate. But I don't know where he's ultimately wanting to take that on his map. And it may be that there are many different places, but I think the fact that he is going ahead and dipping in here and there and saying, you know, I'm going to veer off left here where it's, you know, slightly more experimental. I'm going to go back right here where it is, you know, like a trope that like all the audience is going to understand. I'm going to take it here and there. I'm going to take it to this personalized way. And I'm going to take it to this broad sort of almost polemical way. It's just that kind of inspiration of watching somebody in the span of 5 minutes, like just go.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love the description of the image of the hands, just in terms of how we connect and yeah.
Well, I guess I'll kind of approach the question on two different registers. One being, you know, in your question, Martine, and I'm interested to hear you also, you know, speak about, I think, you know, having talked before, the film that you're kind of...
Yes.
but that, knowing that and just kind of thinking about that, and, it, you know, it had me think so in terms of form, traditional form or the apparatus itself, quote unquote, you know, it has me thinking about the internet and the ways in which the internet serves as a really rich site for Black cultural production. Like there's a vernacular that's specific mm-hmm. for I think Black folks, and then you know broadly people of color that is very unique, fully realized, and just his own vernacular. And so I'm even thinking of the ways in which people of color are, you know, overly represented in social media use, and how just a lot of current trends come from trends and memes and slang and jokes that become sort of like global. And yeah, in this age, you know, largely stem from young people of color. And so in terms of, you know, documentary and or nonfiction film, I think, you know, being unapologetic in the kind of, in the forms of our vernacular, specifically as it relates to young people, which I guess I'm not like really in that set anymore, but like, you know, just being unapologetic and owning that and incorporating that in the ways in which people communicate, people who work in film or video, the way that that's incorporated in their work. And yeah, so I think an ownership of that and just like an acceptance of the ways in which the internet and has democratized communication and expression. So that's one thing. And then also, you know, it also has me thinking of Sophia Nolly Allison and her film, A Love Song for Latasha, about Latasha Harlins, who was a young Black teen that was killed. And those are one of the kind of things that set off the LA uprisings, so-called LA riots, LA 92. So it's like Rodney King and the sentence that Latasha Harlan's killer got, kind of those things in equal measure set off LA 92, although obviously most of us know about Rodney King. Latasha Harlins has been represented in a couple different forms, you know, or it has been represented in pop culture. Tupac has a song about her, so on and so forth, represented as kind of minor characters in narrative films. But with your question and like, I think different ways of making and thinking, for me, not only is it the film that Sophia made, and I mean, the production value is super high. Sophia comes from a photography background. You know, like the folks on it have had access to things that, you know, maybe traditionally. Yeah, so it's not necessary. So although the film is amazing and there's that, it's also for me about like the way in which it was made, like the ways in which, you know, talking to Sophia, knowing Sophia, knowing her creative producer, Janice, on the film, the ways in which like trust and joy led the making of it more than like, I want to get this grant or get into this festival or like try to have some definitive voice about, you know, what's kind of left on the cinematic record for Latasha Harlins. It was, this is, you know, kind of like about our community, meaning in this case, Sophia, in a certain sense, having grown up in LA, but about making sure that trust and care between Black women especially is upheld, and having that be the foremost arbiter, I think, of like her feeling happy with the film that she made, rather than, you know, I mean, it was just it was acquired and released on Netflix recently, and you know, it's gotten, you know, acclaim and done the festivals and all that, but it really being like, you know, if the you know, Latasha Harlan's friends or family, of which, you know, she formed a very serious bond and relationship with, if there was something that made them uncomfortable, that was going to be the primary, you know, that would be paramount to the kind of like the be all end all as it relates to how this, you know, navigates the film industry or what it does for Sophia's career or what have you. So like the privileging of that trust and care for me feels very central when I think about your question.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for that, both of you. I'm also hearing we could go in so many directions around African-American vernacular online and like digital blackface, but I love your inclusion of care, of making sure there's a mindfulness both as a filmmaker, but also knowing the ways that Black women particularly are remixed online and become, you know, it's this responsibility, both the film that you're making, but that other layer that we have to know how that will be taken in another context. And I kind of keep thinking this feeling of alchemy, or this feeling of how can you transmute the messages that are inherently particular stereotypes to this is a contained space of belonging. And your belonging is not, which I think for all BIPOC filmmakers, curators, but your belonging is not qualified by the grants or the festivals that you're in, that this is the film that you wanted to make to rewrite this narrative and make new maps, make new spaces for others so that more folks can come along. And I love how you define that in a way that feels just reverential for the filmmaker, for their care. Yeah. So so the film, I two directions also in terms of the, one of the films that brought to mind that I had selected to talk about is Club Quarantine, which is an op doc New York Times recently shared. And the filmmaker, she's a young filmmaker at Stanford. And Club Quarantine is this magical place on digital belonging, where at the beginning of the pandemic, every night of the week, there was a dance party on Zoom. And for at least 4 months, I think. And so she took these people from all across the world, queer people, and kind of this bearing witness of each other's day, evening, moment, and whether they were very engaged with the camera or whether they were just having their own kind of transformative process being witnessed every night. And so her short is really just the voyeurism, the deconstruction of here I am, I'm just in my home in this pandemic that we could have never pictured, and how am I allowing myself to show up? And it's very minimalist. It, you know, the budget, it was through Zoom. She's re-editing and cutting pieces of interviews that she composed, but also highlights of the regular party. And I find it to be so magnetic because it's, I mean, not only are we living that right now, but the idea that without a pandemic, you would never have thousands of queer people, primarily of color, in this space connecting with each other. And this sense of digital belonging, how can you kind of claim digital space in a way that isn't that negative remix I just implied, but really a place of joy and glitter and neon and personality. How much can you get through this connection with strangers and this sense of intimacy? So I find that project, Club Quarantine, a really, in the same way that we talked about care, a really formative place of care. And I've been thinking about that a lot. What is digital space and how can it be a place of care? I don't know if anyone else has that experience of online life.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can ask you, Martine and Janelle, and really interested in what you were both sharing. How do these experiences kind of become additive, expansive experiences in your minds? And how are you sort of thinking of your curatorial practice in terms of audiences, right, in this very different moment of we're not gathering theaters, we're not necessarily gathering in a multimedia, you know, installation space. So how is that generated, and is that energy able to be captured in an online way? It's an interesting moment, right? Because I do feel like there are these moments of magnetism, as you said, Martine, when you're really sort of just taking part in, you know, whether it's a kind of screening and conversation where suddenly, you know, the comment line is on fire, or, you know, people have a way to plug in and be present, or, you know, be kind of vicariously enjoying it. But also, you know, just really missing that kind of energy and magnetism that comes from physically being present in a space. And so wondering, you know, how do you capture that kind of, you know, just energy that really comes off of seeing bodies in space and in that communal, mm-hmm. also that communal expression, right? Of just like hearing a crowd respond to a screen.
mm-hmm. No, that's such a good question. I mean, I think I haven't gotten the chance to curate a specific program during this time, but what I've noticed or what I've been very mindful of and looking forward is normally if we're at a festival, we're thinking about, you know, how will the lineup work with where the audience is that day? What does it look like in the schedule? But I'm very aware of how oversaturated people are with media and technology. And so I worry about them being able to be fully present with the work. And I'd love to know from both of you how you might navigate that, because it's kind of an over, maybe just how I think, I'm like overly trying to anticipate, like, how will they fully experience this? How could you make it so that they really give it the space it deserves, whether it's a short or a feature or a panel? Is it, you know, having one short a day as opposed to, you know, multiple blocks of films? Is there a way that you can capture people asynchronous that feels meaningful to you? So yeah, I don't think I have a full container for it just yet, but I'd love to hear your thoughts and learn from you.
Yeah, it's really, I feel like I don't have like some super deep definitive answer, because, you know, it's like, it just like, it is what it is, like it is what it has to be. And I mean, like, you know, I'm sure we all have viewed lots of online programs since the beginning of the year. And, you know, there's times when like I can't give something my full attention. Even, you know, we have to have a certain stamina around watching a lot of things because it's part of our job. But like, you know, sometimes it's just not gonna happen. And even with that in mind, I've still had transcendent experiences over the last 7-8 months with things that I haven't been, like I have been just sat there full attention. Like there's been times where I've had to kind of be multitasking, and I've still like really communed with the work, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that our traditional ways of being, you know, sat down in a dark theater or in a gallery space or whatever, I don't think that something that looks and feels different than that precludes, you know, true communion engagement or with whatever we're watching and experiencing. And so I'm just okay with that. And like, I, you know, sometimes I have a really short attention span, like just, it's just who I am. And I can accept that and be okay with that. And I value the fact that this allows for people to engage with things in a different way when they might not have been able to do that before, because maybe you can go back and watch it several times or, you know, online or what have you. And I'm okay with that. And in terms of, I think, the kind of initial part of your question about like the additive of the work, again, I don't know if I have a definitive answer, but it's hard. It's difficult for me because I think sometimes I second guess, you know, like what I'm doing. And, you know, I was just reading this interview that Murari Garima gave to Interview Magazine, and about his recently released film, which is, you know, technically a narrative film, but definitely integrates nonfiction elements. He, you know, he was asked about, you know, the power of art. And, you know, kind of that question that a lot of cultural producers get. And, you know, he said, like, I, you know, it's hard for him. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but, you know, like overestimating the power of art when, you know, if someone's in a community that's being gentrified and they are food insecure, you know what I mean? Their material concerns are like over here and are kind of like, you know, socially formed conversations about a documentary film are over here. You know what I mean? It's just like two different things. Mm-hmm. But in the ways in which, you know, advocating for, you know, democratic or decolonial representation, and because of the havoc that, you know, the havoc of, you know, that the, like, the racist colonial legacy of film, you know, has wrought on different communities of people, that I guess if we can double down on, you know, saying that this is what we're working for, then that's the value of our work. So I kind of like oscillate between those two kind of modes of thinking. Sometimes I can be as committed and in love with my work as I am. Sometimes I can be a cynic. I mean, think about, probably. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like,
I definitely do.
Yeah.
Thinking about this year, it's like, how can you not? So in terms of the additive, I guess, of the work, it's just like, just, I don't know, just also just doing the work and being, and being, and feeling blessed that I can hold space for people, advocate for filmmakers, present the work of filmmakers and artists that touch me. So like, that's the additive, I guess, you know what I mean? And also just what this allows us, like bringing people, like we wouldn't be having all these conversations with like a filmmaker here and a person on the other side of the world, because that was not the mode in which people did the work and did the programs and did the conversations, but now we have to. And so sometimes someone might kind of, like tonight I have a program at Red Cat and I will have a filmmaker joining from the UK and it'll be 6 a.m. her time, right, and we're doing at 10 p.m. here. And someone wouldn't have like been like, okay, I'm gonna, you know what I mean? At this really weird time. But now it's like you privilege that kind of time frame. So
nice. Yeah, I think even having the space for these kind of conversations, right, where we can be equivocal about our practice, you know, where sometimes it's just like, you know, this is the top line thing, and other times it's just like perspective, you know, but those two things flip-flop between each other.
Definitely.
And Janelle, can I just ask you, when you say hold space, it's such a evocative phrase. And I just love it, kind of coming from that kind of curator's perspective, right? Because so often you're holding space in so many different kinds of ways. So I just wonder, like, how would you define that, if I may ask?
Okay, so partially, I think, you know, just in the way I approach work, like I think just as a person, an individual, I am a listener. I'm a listener, and I'm just like a lover of people. I love to meet new people and listen to people. I'm sure we all do. But like one of the most fun parts of doing what I do is just talking to people. Like even during this period over the last few months, you know, there's folks that I've just cold emailed and had meetings with, and they've been so lovely. Yeah, like followed their work maybe for a little bit, but we're chatting and talking for the first time, and the conversation goes on for hours, and I feel like we've been friends for years. And so even if at the end of that meeting or whatever isn't like some immediate path forward to working together or something like that, it's the joy of meeting someone. And, you know, and just like hitting it off and building a rapport. And so with that in mind, holding space is really, you know, making sure that no matter what, there's a container for the ways in which we live in the world, because inherently, you know, especially for the working with mostly Black artists and filmmakers, and to secondary consent, secondarily mostly, you know, artists and filmmakers of color, the world is just inherently violent for so many of us. So, you know, as much as I love to and can get down in the weeds of form and technique and a kind of intellectual rigor, you know, like, and we'll do that. And that's not always the conversation, or that's not always the most important part of the conversation. I just like to talk to people and listen to people and make sure they feel like, you know, the program that's being put on or whatever sort of like framework of the conversation that we're having is one that is affirming. And then also when there is, you know, constructive, I don't want to say debate, but a back and forth and a challenging and a holding people accountable in a different way, you know what I mean, that happens with love and care as well. And also, you know, in thinking of care, which I've obviously mentioned a couple of times, you know, I also try to think about the ways in which I just like interact with people and really hoping that I can, you know, avoid transactional feeling interactions, and you know, so that, you know, like making sure that is something I keep in mind is also a part of holding space and just like talking to people as people and making sure the space that's kind of projected out into the world, you know, in our conversation in this program is one that, yeah, that has like literal and figurative space for talking through things.
Just holding space is such a form of practice in terms of spiritual practice or artistic practice of welcoming in a container. So that is, I love that you pulled that out. It makes me think of one of the film that kind of inspired this conversation for me is The Sea Runs Through My Veins by Zara Zendaya. She's a German-Iranian filmmaker. And it's sort of this lovely, poetic, lyrical film with four different subjects who have either been in situations of exile, trauma, or building a new life. And it's sort of this lyrical poem. It's told in Farsi, Hebrew, German, and English. But there's this line in there that I wrote down, I went back to in preparing for this. And I realized that I was feeling very little bit deflated by this time that we're in. And I watched the movie twice just because I needed to go back to what it was offering me. But one of the subjects says, your moments of joy and happiness are places in time. If you try to hold on to them, you're trying to hold time. And that there's this sensation when we're with an audience, whether they're bringing their own story, we are all constantly walking around the world with our own story, our own presence and energy. And we get to share this place and time where we overlap with that film that I consider so special and such an honor. So we have this intersection with the filmmaker and the experience that they've shared with the subject. And what you said, Janelle, about transactional relationships, like 100%, that really stood out for me because there's a sense of spiritual, whether it's religion or not, but like an energetic that I love with artists, of course, but with anyone that can really be fully present with you. And I think there are a few cultural, there are a few cultural experiences where you are totally invited to be fully present with another person. And that is the calling and that is the request that you sit alongside them, so to speak, with their story, with their life. And when we're able to talk to a director, like about what was the time, where did you travel through time to get to this moment and share it with me and look me in the eye and talk about it and how do you connect your audience that way? That's like bliss to me. That is my joy. So these moments of connection and are so special. And I love what Zara's done with this film, because there's a lot of sort of not really collage, but repetitive footage that allows you to, if you were kind of blinking for a moment or you were being invited to this moment, the repetition allows you to be like, no, I'm really here. I'm really present. I'm really going to experience this difficult moment or this joyful moment. There's images of a woman climbing up a sandbar on the beach and her foot keeps slipping and she keeps slipping and then she makes it up there. And then there's a carousel and there's families talking. And I just feel I love projects that allow you to kind of not to play with them. And so I don't know, that made me think of connection in all of those forms. I'm wondering for you both, where does geography play into the types of films that you're pulled to? Are there certain parts of the world or certain representations of diaspora that you're particularly drawn to when we look at making spaces that feel affirming and uplifting?
Yeah, definitely. For me, it's looking at the breadth of the Latinx experience, of really looking at, the complexity of that as it plays across continents and different expressions in the US. And to me, it's really, it's quite interesting to look at that from a language-based perspective. One of the films that I was really thinking a lot about, of sort of going back to this idea of the artist's voice, and also dipping a bit into that animated documentary realm. To me, it's really interesting to look at that kind of mixed genre, because I think it makes a different kind of space for presence, and a different, it kind of widens a space for the viewer or the engager with the work. And it's a short, it's actually, mixed genre in terms of it's really a poem. It's called Accents by Denise Froman is the poet, this wonderful Latinx queer poet who worked with the animator Robertino Zambrano, who's a Filipino animator, to make this film, which is just this fabulous, fantastic, kind of unapologetic reclamation of her mother's voice. And the idea of turning an accent on its head, right, which is, all too often considered, the accent is the thing that's off, right? The accent is the thing that is not hewing to the normative. And it's just this wonderful kind of dance into rhythm and form, and sort of looking at some of the specificities around her own cultural background, but also just... I think in that way, in the way that, the specificity of a storytelling practice opens it up to everyone, of just this wonderful kind of, it's its own score, right? Of following this poet's rhythm, of following the way that they're breaking down language, of following her mother's voice, of reclaiming every moment where, she may have felt ostracized or, thought of as less than in that moment. And, just turning it into this moment that has, I think, so much space for so many different folks coming from, Spanish is such a syncretic language that, is, it draws from the different indigenous languages of the countries that are, pulling from the colonialist tradition as well, and sort of how you reclaim that and make that your own in Spanglish and what have you. And so to me, following that through line, that is the language-based connector between the different communities, and really looking at that broadly, and looking at, how in the US there's a different kind of reclamation as well. But looking at all that overlap in that space is really something that is just so rich to me. And I think carries over that notion of like code switching, and kind of getting back to some of what Janelle was saying about, this vernacular, right? Of like living in that space where we're really like looking at those things and owning those kind of approaches, and seeing where they carry over and where they're distinct and where they create their own communities and where they create a new language, is a particular driver for me.
Yeah, for me, I'm always kind of thinking about diaspora in different ways. And so, you know, I think kind of in thinking about your question, the first thing that comes to mind is Ephraim Asili's That Diaspora Suite. And yeah, I mean, I'm first generation Jamaican. And so for me, I'm always thinking of like, I don't know, like I'm always thinking of migration, movement, mapping, and the complexity embedded in that. And so for Ephraim's The Diaspora Suite, you know, what I really value about that series of five films is that there's not like an overly romanticized kind of like diasporic study. Like that's not what it is. It's really contending with complexity and distance and schism and separation, but in a way that I think allows us as people watching it, as viewers, to do a lot of work ourselves. You know, it demands active spectatorship. And, you know, one of the films, Kinda, which is largely set in Jamaica and really embeds the history of the Maroons and some of the Maroon leaders and just kind of like some customs of Maroon communities. You know, even that has like a lot of complexity in it, you know, like the ways in which the Maroons being slaves that escaped from slave owners or were also like in open revolt against the British. I mean, there is complexity embedded in that because there were like deals made with the British. You know, so it's not a blanket 100% version of Black liberation during that time. You know, there was like an element of complicity. And I value that. And I value like having hard conversations amongst different diasporas.
Yeah. And I think that's super interesting what you're saying, Janelle, you know, mm-hmm. that like cross diasporic history of, you know, thinking about, for instance, the Filipino and Latin American crossover, you know, there are a million different ways to parse in and a million different under-examined histories and all of this as well, right, of the Afro-Latino experience. And also, it's making me think a little bit about how, I think it's getting back to your point, Janelle, about like self-examination and examining one's own practice. I think the other things that are really speaking to me right now, I'm thinking of The Infiltrators, the doc, I don't know if you know it, by Christina Ibarra and Alex Rivera, where you're really sort of flipping the script in terms of, you know, how one goes about instigating this examination in a practice and creating your own kind of syncretism in terms of the documentary exploration and the storytelling, and also, you know, the practice is action of like that multi-layered thing, right, where you're having to follow it, break it all down, kind of create your own critique, right, of what you think of those different artistic practices, of what you think of that political practice, of where you situate yourself and all of that. And I think so much of the diasporic examination for us is also, you know, self-examination of where we are in our own kind of immigration histories. For me, it's always been a little bit of a stumbling block because my family is split right in the middle where I have older siblings who were born in Mexico. And then I'm of that little unit that was born in the US. So even within this kind of generational thing, you know, you're like questioning sort of authenticity and sort of who's able to tell the story from what perspective, right? When I tell the story of my family, it's a slightly different story than my oldest siblings, certainly than my parents. But I think that whole messy complexity of perspective and who's telling the story and how it's being framed is what is really interesting and speaking to me in terms of documentary practices right now, is that it's this messy shiftingness between those different kinds of forms and vantage points. I don't know, maybe I can send this back to you, Martine, but how do we capture our own process in this and kind of like, it's almost like, you know, a child doing math problem, like show your work, like how are we showing our work? You know, what is the problem that we're trying to solve for? You know, kind of how are we capturing all this wonderful, hopefully generative messiness?
Mm-hmm. No, that's such a good point. I mean, I'm so enjoying diving into the thoughts that both of you are sharing. That's sort of why I thought this conversation, but also it's a sort of a backwards planning qualified by like, what is it that we feel is most desired? What is it that we most want to see? And how do we backwards plan to the types of conversations? You know, you can't have these difficult conversations if you haven't developed kind of the safe container to introduce films that challenge the narratives that people are continually trying to break free from. So I think it's our role to figure out, and with our own process or healing and orientation, to say, I'm inviting this question, I'm inviting this conversation. I don't know the answer, but I want to think together with you. I want to believe that there is a socially engaged imagination that includes not having a single answer, just like we don't have a single story. There is no one way forward. And I look for films that allow that invitation, because I find sometimes that can be very jarring for an audience. You brought me on this journey and now you're just leaving me in this open space with more questions. But those are my favorite projects. So I think, I don't know if that's your experience as well, but it's a sense of we are the caretakers of invitation. That's sort of what I think about in terms of being a curator as well. So there's a joy in that, but I'm transformed by the process, because I'm not going to ask the same question if the audience maybe wasn't there to say, oh, this is what I thought about that. This is what came up for me. This is the next generation of filmmakers that came out of that. I also resonated with what you said about the messiness of perspective. And Janelle, I think you touched on that as well. Because especially in documentary, there might be things that ripple up within production or after a film where it challenges the narrative and subject. But it was true when you started, because our lives are messy. Our human experience, our culture, our politics are messy. And so there is that honor of good intentions. It was true when I began the journey. Even in my own family story, there were things I thought were true that were not. So I think that that's something we all investigate when we, especially in the diaspora, especially people of color, to honor where we find ourselves.
That's a really potent way of putting it, Martine, to honor where we find ourselves. And you know, I wonder for anyone, but especially for a young audience, to honor where we find ourselves can be incredibly vulnerable, right? I mean, it is probably de facto incredibly vulnerable, unless you've got an amazingly outsized ego, and I don't think I don't think that's here, right?
No.
I don't think that's what we're trafficking in, hopefully most of the time. But to honor where we find ourselves, right, and having the courage to have that be in flux, and mm-hmm. have that vulnerability, like how do we create that? How do we create enough safety around our audiences for that to to be something that they are comfortable walking with,
mm-hmm.
stepping into and then walking with.
Yeah. That's a really good question. For me, it's one that I think about a lot, you know. I wish, you know, sometimes I wish there were, you know, I have varied interests. I love a lot of things. I love to learn about a lot of things. But sometimes I feel like, especially certain communities, especially communities of color, need their own space to work stuff out. And that's kind of like, that's impossible. You know what I mean? Like if you make a documentary, I mean, you want people to see it. And then it also needs to travel because you need to be able to get grants. And you know what I mean? Like people, like filmmakers, obviously need to find a way to undergird their career in a very fickle economy. But so sometimes I wonder how to create and maintain safe spaces. I think there are so many conversations that can't be fully had in documentary nonfiction film because it has to be sort of like cut, released, and distributed with an audience in mind that might not be invested in the safety, well-being, psychic wellness of maybe the community or group of people that might, you know, that are maybe central to the doc or the film. You know, like there's so many. I'm really bothered by, there's like a lot of just like a historicity in the world. Like I feel like largely there's just like so much misrepresentation, and I'm just saying in a very, very, very general sense, not specific to film or documentary or anything, but there's just a lot of misrepresentation of like facts and the history, just like history, you know what I mean? And there's like, sometimes I get kind of concerned about the foundation and us, like just like what documentaries are being released out into and the myriad ways it can be misrepresented or not understood fully because I just think that there's, I don't know. I'm really trying not to be condescending, but I just like, there's just like subtleties and nuances that I find are missing from most social conversations in general, just in the world. And, you know, so I'm also just kind of thinking of like, also like what kind of broader conversations and education and programmatic stuff that, you know, we can do as arts workers to make sure that there's like a social infrastructure incubated that is like, up to receiving what people are expressing and communicating. I mean, no one person can do that. Like, you know, I mean, it's just a thought, but so, cause I think that there's a lot of messy conversations that, you know, messy and like fruitfully challenging conversations that I like start to have or I'm interested in having with different sorts of people, but it would feel very scary for a filmmaker to like fully broach that in work, because work, like the question of legibility is one that can be very inhibitive, you know. But I think legibility is important. Like legibility in a material sense is important. And it's not only is it important, it's like projected onto things because of industries that are still largely not diverse, I guess one could say. So if you're working with distributors, you're working with, you know what I mean? Like, and you're thinking of like, or also programmers, like just industry, thinking of industries and the ways in which obviously there's a long way to go, which is not news to any of us or anyone listening. But, you know, so not only is legibility important, but it's also like, sometimes seems like a central barometer that I feel like still inhibits things.
No, that's a really good point. I think it might not necessarily be our role in the process, but I see a lot of the social impact producer space sort of packaging certain documentaries, and you're looking at the ethics around the film, and that might not translate to the entire release of the film, and to assess a project over something that is separate and additive and needed to be sort of, if it's not on the screen, if it's not in the film, I sometimes feel it's not fair to say that we can base the intentions or the team and the issues of equity. And I'm trying to be thoughtful with my words too. I don't want to put anyone, I really appreciate how you said that, Janelle. Yeah. I'm so curious, I've been on a journey with you both, which is lovely. As we kind of wind back into this open space, I feel like we've made a circle, we've made a container to sort of hold a lot of questions, which is maybe the best kind of map that we're sort of, it's the container. What is something that you touch on this a bit, Janelle? What do you want to see more of? Whether it's a genre, medium, questions that you want the world to consider, issues. I have so many, but I'm curious how, not only your interests of what you'd love to curate, but what do you think we, big question, what does the world need? Yeah.
Yeah, like more support for emerging or even student films and filmmakers. And so not just like cartoning them off in like sidebars or whatever, but there's a friend or someone I used to know that, you know, was at one point he was writing a dissertation, and one of the segments of the dissertation was going to be about the educational mode of production, like the things that people made as students and understanding their validity, and not just the validity, but like the ways in which, if anything, sometimes that stuff like really is like so expansive in a way that maybe sometimes it's not always possible to reproduce once you leave school, because you write about eligibility and having a career. And so like something that I try to do is really find a space to present the value in early work, So I mean, that's something that I should also be doing more of myself, you know what I mean? Like, it's also aspirational for me, but I think particularly as it relates to filmmakers of color, I would love to see more of that in a broader sense. And I feel like I need more time to think about, like, that's just what came to me at the top.
Yeah. But, yeah. You can keep adding.
No, I can't think of it right now. So
No, not now. I mean, yeah.
It's I'll wait.
I would love to see more consistent representations of youth of color, whether it's in the children's film space, because I feel that I feel really strongly that it's an issue around power and who has the privilege of being vulnerable. And for young people, I kind of see it as this exploration of, it's childhood is a space and time that we don't get to visit again ourselves as adults, but they are in motion, and to have a respect for that process is a practice in how we view culture and society. So I really want to see more and celebrate up and coming filmmakers or filmmakers who've been dedicated to young people's stories in a way that feels empowering That's a big concern for me. And a little bit more around, we have a lot of conversation around the climate crisis. There's a lot to do with climate grief that I think also works with a sense of resonance and great love for the environment and for Indigenous community and for relationships with land, that we need to have more complex conversations around, and particularly center filmmakers of color. So all of those things, but just more stories is always wonderful.
Martin, can you talk a little bit about how you I'd love to hear a little more detail about the youth space and kind of how you, where you are finding the gratification in working in that space, and where you'd like to see the amplification a bit more.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk about that for ages. I think, and it definitely is where we have access or where we're being invited to curate. But as I've been kind of broadening spaces recently, there is a lot of conversation around the commercial children's media and brand tie-ins, things for young people that are about treating them as consumers. And I really feel very challenged by that, because I think we should have more opportunities to see them as collaborators and connectors of their own experiences and stories and living their own lives. So I think there needs to be a more constructive conversation around what we mean when we're talking about young people's stories. So I intentionally don't often say children's media. I tend to say young people's stories, cinematic childhood. I want a cinematic childhood that's a language that we collectively can talk about. One of my favorite, you know, narrative films growing up is E.T. And I think about what if every child had the equivalent reference point for a documentary about kids of color in the same scale that that project, you know, that we all love. And so there's a sense of imaginative play and wonder that is a justice issue for kids of color, because they don't get the privilege of the same kind of innocence in public space, I feel. Yeah.
I think for me, it's also just building upon what you're saying, Martine, of they don't get the same space for innocence, and also they don't necessarily get the same space for sophistication is not quite the word, but a sort of depth of experience. Yes. You know,
completely.
I definitely find that is something that I'm kind of trying to actively work against, is that you know, kids are the best indicators of, you know, a lack of sincerity and a lack of respect towards an audience. You know, they really want to have complex experiences, and experiences that aren't, you know, stripped of a multiplicity of emotions. And so for me it's very important to give young people that space, and also to realize that there's a huge amount of crossover, you know, of a lot of the programming that I do at the New York International Children's Film Festival is actually drawn from other research into other festivals that are screening, you know, really smart shorts, certainly looking at different specific BIPOC programming, so that we have that authenticity of different storytelling lenses. But really, they're sophisticated stories, and there's there's no reason why, you know, being mindful of sort of what your level of audience is, you can't carry them over, and there aren't other points of entry in spaces that you would have never discovered otherwise. So that's definitely something for me, and especially for BIPOC filmmakers to be telling those stories in their own voices, and to be creating those spaces where it is a audience to filmmaker conversation, and that, you know, that really important notion of owning your own story, right? Of a young person seeing that from the very start of saying, you know, you are going to have all kinds of experiences. Many of them wonderful, many of them not. But, you know, my goal is for you to own your story and find a point of entry into that and to see these transformative works where, you know, an artist has found a space to take you on a journey, and that you're sort of, you're invited into that. So that's super important for me. And the other thing is just like circling back to you all in this amazing conversation and kind of thinking again how you introduced us into this, Martine, of having a space of wonder and questioning. And there's been a documentary that's really been sitting with me for a while. It's a short doc that was I saw right at the beginning of the pandemic. It's called May Day, The Art of Building Community. And it's a short that some filmmakers through Third World Newsreel put together. And it has to do with a wonderful collective of activists / artists who were looking at gentrification issues here in New York City. And it was just really evocative work. And it was really difficult for me, like working both in a kind of film theater-based space, but also in an installation-based space, and having worked in museums and kind of, you know, art spaces where you have this amazing mandate to invite the public into experience work, right? But you're always coexisting with the art market. So there were these wonderful artist activists who had done these fantastic kind of light sculptures and other interventions where they were pointing to these moments of gentrification in different communities, you know, of buildings changing hands, of development, of this and that. And they were just these really strong, amazing, just beautiful like signs and really great, you know. I was just like, I want to put this in a gallery, you know, I want to do this installation thing. I want everybody to come. It's incredibly powerful. And yet those artists themselves and the documentarian's approach to it were about resisting that, right? Of very much holding themselves into the space of activism and using art to call attention to something, but resisting that kind of commodification. And so myself in that mix was very much feeling that tension, because I kind of, you know, part of me was just, you know, blown away by their commitment to being dedicated to that, whether that was sort of the original impetus of what they were doing, or whether they weren't exactly existing in that kind of more gallery museum space yet, but being very beholden to that, and me also seeing the power of that and seeing the potential of that kind of activated in an art space and what it could do. Mm-hmm. But being in this moment where we're really split down the middle, right? Of like, how do you create an activist art that's truly transformative, right? And how do you kind of figure out that liminality between art, right? How are you defining art, and how are you defining activism? And just the fact that stayed with me through, you know, this intense journey that, you know, the past 7 months has taken us, you know, it seems kind of meaningful, right? That I'm still like in that place of tension, and I want to see more works like that, and more getting back to the wonder things, just more spaces like this where we can, you know, just say like, I'm not sure, you know, like, yes, this was this interesting tension. This is this interesting question. Like, how do we respond as, you know, someone who's blown away by the art and the wonder of what someone is doing, and how do we reconcile that with our practice as curators and programmers? And I just want to find more work like that, or, yes, you know, coexist in a space with you all, really.
Yes.
Where we have those dialogues.
Well, thankfully, full circle, that's why we have POC too. We have this collective where we just need to have more mixers. We need to get together again. I just want to thank you both so much for your time and for having this space, creating this beautiful, like I can see it as a watercolor. We've created this watercolor of ideas and questions, and we get to continue to investigate them. If everyone listening is now a fan of you, as I am, where can they find you, or how would they continue to support your practice? Anyone can jump in.
That's a good question.
Yeah. you can find me scattered about.
We can leave it a mystery, but definitely follow the film, the New York International Children's Film Festival, social media wise, of course.
Third World Newsreel is doing some fantastic stuff. I also am a longtime art worker, to use Janelle's phrase, which I really appreciate with them. And so many spaces.
Yes. Yeah, Los Angeles Film Forum. Is the LAfilmforum.org.
Great.
I program for them. Yeah.
And same for me. I think the nature of our work is that we get to travel in virtual spaces now. So, but really, it just means the world to have such resonance for discovery. I feel like that's what, for curiosity, for evolution, for healing, with you all. And I'm so glad to have this conversation.
I did want to give a shout out to POC2 Collective, because it's just it's a great space, and you know, just been so welcoming. And also to invite folks, specifically BIPOC filmmakers, to submit to the New York International Children's Film Festival, and to reach out to me through that, and make sure we make that easy and fee-free for you all to do that, because as you said, Martine, it's so important to you know, get these stories out to young audiences. So please do find me there.
Yes. Well, thank you both so much. You can, and of course, everyone can go to POC2, the Programmers of Color Collective, and learn more about the work. If you're a programmer and you want community, you get to meet lovely folks like this. So thank you so much for having us. And also a special shout out to Lucy McCurgy. This would not be happening without her incredible support and curation.